The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Ellen Rupol Shell. Ellen is a professor of journalism at Boston University and a correspondent for The Atlantic. She is a National Magazine Award finalist whose writing has been selected for the Best American Science Writing. She's written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Smithsonian, Slate, and Scientific American. She is the author of Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. And she has a new book. It's called The Job, Work and Its Future in a Time of Radical Change. Ellen, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
In the introduction to your book, you say that in today's America, quote, work is just not working for us. What are the ways in which that is true, sort of broadly speaking?
Well, I think many of us understand that globalization and digital technology have changed work radically, or at least our jobs. And as a consequence of those two factors, many middle-class or mid-level jobs have gone away. And the fastest-growing jobs are low-wage, so-called low-skill jobs. There is a smattering of more high-skill, high-wage jobs, but the largest category right now are the lower-wage, low-skill jobs. So despite the fact that we have this remarkably low unemployment rate, last I looked, it was about 3.9 or 9%, or what economists call full employment, many of us are feeling that our job just isn't doing it for us.
Yeah. And there's a lot of surprises in the book, which we will get to later in the conversation. But you have this origin story around Marienthal, Austria. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
You are.
Okay. I'm killing it with the pronunciations today.
You are.
Let's take a moment
job.
To celebrate myself. All right. So Marienthal is 15 miles southeast of Vienna. Second City has performed in Vienna for like decades, so I'm very familiar with that place. But this is the story about this factory town and its proximity to Viennese psychologists, right, was fortuitous. Tell us a little bit about this town and why it opens your book.
Yeah, I start in Marienthal, which is a very unlikely place to start a book about the United States in the 21st
right.
century, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I felt it had some very powerful lessons to teach us, and that is because Marienthal was a factory town. It was a textile town, and it had a large factory where most of the people in the town were employed. Both men, women, and also many children were employed in this factory in the 1920s and prior to then for a good long time. So people had moved from the farms to the factories, to this particular factory and affiliated factories, and were quite happy to be there because it was quite a prosperous town. They had all sorts of things that many of us associate with a nice middle-class life, beautiful parks, libraries, schools, kindergartens, good health care, all these things. But in the Great Depression, in the late 1920s, the call for textiles that were produced in this factory declined and eventually kind of evaporated. So the factory closed, and almost everybody in this town was out of a job.
Mm.
Now, what was interesting is at that time, a lot of theorists, a lot of academics, social scientists thought, people will be kind of pushing back on this. They will rebel. They will unite in rebellion against the government or capitalism or something, because there they are, left without a job. And in fact, what happened was not that at all. What happened was the people began to bicker among themselves. Mm-hmm. The citizens of this hamlet were you know, angry with each other, fought, bickered, would accuse each other of being welfare cheats, and went so far as to steal each other's pets, which is was quite remarkable. Some of these pets, it turns out, were being eaten, the dogs, which is a kind of a gory story. But in any case, the social scientists who went down there to check this out were really quite surprised about all this. So I use this as an introduction to the book because it's a cautionary tale, and also because it was the first time that social scientists recognized how important work was, not only to sustain us financially, but to sustain us emotionally.
Yeah, because you're in essence taking the job away seems like it's also taking the dignity away, which is sort of core to our human existence.
It did, but there was a corollary to this story that is often not told in the recounting of the story, and that is that some people did thrive, at least certainly that maybe thrive is too strong a word, but did much better than others. And those were the people, both the men and the women, who continued to work, mm-hmm. not in the factory, but in their lives. So they might start a cottage business. They might, for example, some raised rabbits. Some did crafts. The women in particular did not decline to the degree that the men did, mm-hmm. because they continued to take care of their children and continued their daily life. And in fact, they slept less than the men did by about an hour and a half a night. They continued their life even though they no longer had work in the factory. They had a good deal of work in their everyday life. But the men also, a certain group of men, a subset of the men, sought more time with their families and hobbies, and found ways also to cobble together a small income. And these were called the unbroken. This is what the social scientists called the unbroken. So I feel that this story has a lot to teach us about the difference between work, which we cannot live without, and a job.
Sure, and so relevant in our national conversation, which is this reckoning we're going to face, you know, in terms of all the jobs that aren't paid for, right? The caregivers, the people raising children, all, you know, the not categorized as a job. I was finishing reading your book. I actually finished it, and that evening I was asked to be on a panel about art and innovation. And one of the questions during the Q&A was, what should we stop doing in business? And I immediately quoted your book, and I did reference it. I said, stop hiring for cultural fit. Now, I want to make a note of this, that I worked at Second City for 30 years, and often my job was like I was the last person that you interviewed with to make sure you would sort of fit in with our culture. So I come from a place of like very much sort of living in like, oh, no, that's so important to the culture. But I am a convert. I am a convert to stop hiring for cultural fit, and to tell our audience why that is so important.
Well, first of all, I'm delighted that I changed your mind about this, and I hope you, at this conference, I hope you changed a few minds as well, because I think this is very damaging, both to individuals and to business itself. Okay, so in the case of the individuals, after the prologue, which we just talked about, I talk about a case of a real life story of a guy who found himself unable to find a job despite his incredible resume. You know, he had a master's degree from an Ivy League school in business. He had an undergraduate degree from an Ivy League school. Mm-hmm. He had incredible work experience, management experience. He was very techno-savvy. He had everything. And Yet he was unable to find a position commensurate with his experience. And as a consequence of this, he tried really, really hard to create this kind of chemistry. He was trying to figure out, why am I not a fit? What is wrong with me? And it was really very sad because he was trying to change, as much as he possibly could to comport with the prevailing corporate culture. And there was nothing wrong with this guy. He was a terrific guy, actually. He had three kids. He volunteered. He had a great three-point shot in basketball. He was just a great all-around guy. So that was really, really sad. So on an individual level, when we try to contort ourselves to fit a certain corporate culture, we do a disservice to ourselves. And employers who look for this fit are often looking for people like themselves.
Yep.
That's what they look for. And in fact, in many elite professions, one of the surest way of getting a job with an employer is to have shared leisure activities. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So if you play squash, you may be able to get a job at that law firm. And if you played football, that signals to the law firm that you're not the right fit.
Right.
For example. Okay. So what they're basically looking for is a reflection of themselves, and that does a real disservice to the business because you want diversity not just because it's the right thing to do, but because it strengthens your team. It gives you, a diverse team is more likely to be more creative. It's more likely to question the common wisdom that's led you astray. There are all sorts of reasons why you want diversity. And when you're looking for fit, and that means you're looking for someone like you, you often don't get that diversity that is so important for successful business.
Yeah, that reminded me of that story about, I think, Daryl Morey, who was the Houston Rockets GM. He took a class in behavioral economics, and then he came back and he basically ordered his scouts that they could no longer, if they were comparing an up-and-coming player, they couldn't compare him to a player of the same race. Because he found that they were like always saying, oh, yeah, it's an elite Hakeem Olajuwon type. And they're like, because he's African and dark skinned and tall, when the game was completely different. But we're subject to those biases, not just in looking for people like ourselves, but how we see other people.
Absolutely. And how we judge them in general. But in an employment context, it's particularly, unfortunate and unproductive.
Yeah. I titled this, when I do my notes for this, I sort of titled it under section, and I wrote down slaves to our jobs. And I thought this was really interesting. You write in the book, it is no small irony that those of us who claim ownership over our jobs are among the most likely to be owned by our jobs.
Right.
And this has come up, with Elon Musk saying everyone's got to work 80 hours. What a crazy thing he's saying. But, talk to, because there's some science behind how unhealthy this is, these, hours that we put in that turn into being unproductive hours.
Yeah. Researching this book, what I found, especially among young people, which is particularly sad, is if they, young people feel that they're supposed to be passionate about their work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they've been told that. Steve Jobs said that at this famous commencement speech at Stanford about how you should never just settle. You should find work you love and feel passionate about. There's also this idea that I never work a day in my life. I love my job, so it's not work, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's this fantasy out there that we're supposed to be in love with our jobs and feel passionate about our jobs. Most people don't, mm-hmm. actually, and that's fine. But for a lot of young people, and the feedback I got in the interviews I did, they feel that if they don't feel passionate about their job, they should work harder. And they're told that they should work harder to make themselves feel passionate about their job. So in the book, I describe a young banker at Goldman Sachs who worked 3 days straight, got pneumonia, was throwing up in his wastebasket, and still wouldn't leave because, the idea is that he would put in these long, sort of Herculean hours, and that would make him feel passionate and successful and all that. So it is a vicious cycle. not a good idea, doesn't add to productivity, you're working beyond the point of being able to make sense of what you're doing, and it's unfortunate that it's sort of become normalized in many American workplaces.
I was not expecting for a quote from Beat Generation poet Gary Snyder to show up in this book, but you squeezed it in. Bravo.
Thank you. I got to work him into every book.
Oh, I wrote my thesis on the Beat, so yeah, we could go on and on
wow.
about that. So I'm like, oh no, look at that. So I had not heard Snyder. Snyder has this term, a double burden, which is really yeah. interesting. And then actually I read it in another article recently. I'm like, I know what that means. And it refers to this kind of lie that exists when we talk about flattening hierarchies in business, right?
Yes, yes. This idea that we should manage ourselves, or that that we are going to be that there is no hierarchy, when in fact, of course, there is always a hierarchy, and that what happens in a lot of so-called flat hierarchies is similar to almost to what happens in Marienthal, is that they police each other, right?
Right.
And you feel that you have to police yourself, and you have to police others, and so there's a real problem with this notion of flat hierarchy. I mean, in theory, it can be a very good thing that everyone is equal, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, that is rarely the case. So it is a double burden. Snyder also, there's also the problem of, everyone being expected to be their own entrepreneur. You know,
mm-hmm.
this is what we call intrapreneurship. That is, your employees are entrepreneurs on the job.
Right.
So they have a boss, but they're entrepreneurial.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so why are they being entrepreneurial, right? It's not their own business. They're actually working in the service of their employer, which is perfectly fine, but they should not be deluded, or we should try to delude ourselves into thinking that we're doing anything on a job but working for an employer. And I think the Elon Musk example you gave a few minutes ago is a perfect one. The idea that Elon Musk, who will profit, just beyond imagination if he's successful at his venture, would tell everyone else that they have to feel the same way about it as he does, is absurd.
Yeah.
And demand it, and demand their loyalty to that degree. It's absurd.
I wonder if this is one of those both things can be true idea, because, we talk a lot about the sort of flattened hierarchies in our work in improvisation as we apply it to businesses, because we have a whole concept in leadership called follow the follower. And I think that is true on a personal level, that it could work, but it won't work if sort of institutionally you don't have the support there. And we were talking before even the podcast started about the book Winners Take All and on, which I think is very connected to this, that it's also talking about that whole idea of zooming in on the personal. If you're not taking responsible at the macro level, it doesn't matter what you're doing at the micro level.
Well, I'm not sure I know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
the macro and the micro level. Can you explain that to me?
Yeah. So what I'm sort of saying is that you've, especially in the area of the sort of hierarchies that you're talking about, which is you want your people to be entrepreneurial, but not to the detriment of themselves and only to the benefit of the shareholders, right? So there, it has to work both ways.
Right.
It can't be one without the other. And if it is, it's unequal in either way.
Listen, if you want your employees to be creative, to be hardworking, to focus on the task at hand, no one could argue against that. Of course, that's good for you, and it's also good for your employees, because not focusing, being constantly distracted,
mm-hmm.
not putting in a real effort is actually detrimental to the worker, right?
Yeah.
I mean, your job is much more boring if you're not focused on it and you're not excited about it to some degree. But the idea that every bit of creative energy should be put to the goal of the company, that people should go over and above to achieve the goals of the company, that's the question,
yeah.
as opposed to their personal goals. Right?
Right.
You might have a personal goal, and it can be in alignment with your company, but it doesn't mean that you give everything to the success of your company and expect your company to reward you in kind.
Yeah, there's so much I want to talk to you about. You talk about sort of the skill set for the future of work, and there are some surprises in there. I mean, I recall everyone being like, you got to learn to code, you got to learn to code. You know, but then I also think back to the fact that when I was growing up, it was all about owning your house. You know, like that is the thing to do. You quote the Stanford sociologist David Grussey, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and he says, everyone thought that computer skills were key, but from our findings, they were not. All right. So that's, I don't think that's not part of the popular narrative in our country. Everyone thinks you've got to dig in on that's where the jobs are going to be. Are they not?
Right. Well, computer jobs, many, especially routinized kind of computer related jobs, it can be automated, right? I mean, by their very nature, and they are being automated very, very rapidly. So when many of us, when many economists I spoke with and many social scientists I spoke with who would say coding was important, didn't even know what coding was. Okay? I mean, the term is very vague. It's hard to get your hands around. Does it mean facility using computers? Well, you know, an awful lot of 13 and 14-year-olds have facility with computers.
Yeah.
They can use their cell phones. They can use Twitter. They can use social media of all kinds. They are pretty computer fluent, right? Digitally fluent. They're digital natives. They know how to do it. Okay. Now, how many people are actually going to be developers, software developers, and or software architects, or that kind of thing? You know, not that many relative to the population, right? So the high level, you know, computer-oriented jobs, there are certainly a significant number of them, but the vast majority of people will not be filling those roles. So the kind of computer skills that, you know, sort of everyone needs, many of us have already picked up, okay, in the course of young people in particular. They've picked up, they know how to use spreadsheets, they know how to use Excel, you know, they know the basics. And that's what most people use in their day-to-day life at work if they use computers. That's what they use. So the question is, you know, do we need to train people up? Do we need to have, you know, more people, you know, famously, you know, Kentucky coal miners, you know, should they go to coding school?
Right.
Well, you know, there have been many articles about that and a lot of, you know, cheerleading that. But when you drill into that, not many of those people who graduate from those programs actually get jobs. Okay? That's the call for that kind of thing is not nearly as great as is claimed.
And it's not just those jobs, right? I mean, you also talk about like doctors. I mean, it's not just these sort of like what we think of as, you know, equivalent to sort of manual labor type jobs. It's like doctors' jobs are going to be in peril when the robots can do it better.
Right. So listen, there's kind of a misunderstanding or a myth that it's only routine jobs that will be automated. You know, there are machines now that can flip hamburgers. Right.
Yeah.
We have those kind of machines, but we don't use them. Why? Because the people who flip hamburgers are so cheap. They're so low wage. So the golden ring for automation is automating high level jobs, expensive jobs, jobs that you have to pay people high salaries to do. And that's already starting to happen. So, you know, document searches, legal firms, that can be done, you know, either outsourced to India, for example, because of technology allows us to do that. And some of them can also be automated. There are those kinds of jobs are really the computer scientists I spoke with, and I spoke to quite a few, because they're quite worried about this, by the way. People and, you know, computer scientists are worried about what's going to come of their work.
Mm-hmm.
And they know, they're agreed at this point that many, many jobs, many, many functions will be automated. And so it's not going to go away. You know, this is progress. I don't decry this. I just think we have to embrace it. This is the way it's going. So given this, what should we do, right? Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, there's a lot of discussion about what I think we should do in the book, but I don't, I'm not doctrinaire. I think we need to have a national conversation about that.
Right. And this is a good point for me to squeeze in this Charles Darwin quote that you found that no one at Second City knew, and of course now will start appearing on our brochures, which is, in the long history of humankind, those who learn to collaborate and improvise most effectively have prevailed. And I think when we talk about our relevance and why we teach what we do and why we think it's important is that improvisation gives individuals agency and fluency in divergent thinking, in storytelling, in being innovative and resilient. And we feel like when we look at the skills of the future, that really those are the things that, you know, being able to take data but express the story of the data to get to the truth behind the data is something that people will need.
You've really nailed it. There's no question. And in fact, you know, if I had my way, I would think teaching improvisation in schools would be a great thing to be doing, as opposed to teaching any particular computer language, which is going to be outdated by the time the kid graduates from high school, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Being intellectually flexible. You mentioned the social scientist from Stanford before. And what he found, in fact, it was not computer skills, you're right, it was these so-called analytic skills.
Mm.
And improvisation is one of those,
mm-hmm.
okay? Being able to turn on a dime, think independently, and not necessarily only solve the problem, but know what problems need to be solved, right?
Right.
That's what we need to be teaching in the schools, and we should be teaching in high school. It should be something that every high school graduate has, because the vast majority of jobs, even going forward, over the next 50 years, are not going to technically require a college degree.
Yeah.
So every kid that comes out of high school should be prepared for this and ready to do it.
This stat blew me away, and I think it also speaks to another phenomenon or the same phenomenon. Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google, as of the summer of 2016, had a market cap of more than $1.8 trillion. Collectively, they employed fewer than 400,000 Americans. That's crazy.
That was then. Now, of course, Amazon has grown tremendously. It's
yes.
a very large employer now, but mostly, let's remember, in their warehouse.
Yeah.
In their warehouses. So Amazon claims, and it has very, you know, it also bought Whole Foods.
Yep.
So it has a lot of shelf stackers and people work registers, and it's got also a lot of folks who work in warehouses globally,
mm-hmm.
right? So
mm-hmm.
you have to look at those numbers and realize these are global numbers. So you're right. The big players, the largest market cap companies actually don't employ the number of professionals that we think they do. Okay, they don't. They do, you know, in the case of Amazon, as I say, they employ a lot of people who really do not require a college education or advanced skills in that, you know, of any kind. They're not necessarily highly paid, right? So we have to look at, this was, of course, quite different
mm-hmm.
From the old days when, you know, the large automobile companies with unionized workers employed a lot of fairly well-paid workers.
Yeah.
So this has changed radically, and that's what the subtitle of my book is, you know,
mm-hmm.
Work in its future in a time of radical change. This is quite a quick change.
Yep.
In the history of our country, you know, it's a very quick change, and we have not yet adapted to it, but we will. We will adapt to it.
Yeah, yeah. And you have some sort of hopeful models. I wanted to tell you quickly this story. It's in our book, Yes And, that we wrote. But Second City got brought in by the U.S. Department of Education to kick off an event where school board presidents, school superintendents, and teacher union leaders needed to come together to collaborate. And they all hate each other. And
yes.
so, and we're very kumbaya, Yes And. We're like, there is no Yes And here. So we shoved the improv to the side, and we actually used our comedy skills with this. We're like, okay, I think we can unify these folks by someone they collectively they hate together. They hate with a passion together. So what we did is at this conference, they didn't know Second City was there. So instead, they announced that these experts from Finland were going to come in and tell them how to do their job. And we dressed up the actors like with blue hair and these outrageous accents.
That is genius.
Right, right. And so, and you have a whole chapter on Finland.
I do. I have a whole chapter on Finland. I mean, who can resist Finland?
No, they're great. The Finns are amazing, but it's like they are so tired of hearing about Finland.
Of course they are. And that's why I talk about Finland being, you know, having all the problems that we do, right?
Yeah.
They have problems with alcohol. They have problems with everything. One of the funniest things I learned about Finland, of course, was that one of their national sports is the wife-carrying championships. It's you have to go on YouTube and watch them. They're hysterical. Mm-hmm. But in any case, you know, the reason I went to Finland is because, not because of the schools, although that was very interesting, but because Finland was having this national review of work.
Yeah.
They were worried that people in Finland were not happy on the job, and they wanted to know why. I mean, can you imagine that? A national government-funded study of why people were not happy at work. Mm-hmm. So that was irresistible for me. I went there, and I, you know, ran around the country and looked at it. And what was really fun was one of the happiest places to work in Finland was a sausage factory in the north of Finland. It's called Snellman's. And I talked to a guy who worked there. I mean, it's kind of amazing. He had a college degree, a degree in philosophy, of all things. And he was really happy working there. And I, you know, why was he happy working there? Well, he said, first of all, we make really good sausage, so I'm really proud of what we make. But also, they insist that we leave the company every night at 5 o'clock and spend time with our family, and they really insist on that. So Snellman also would offer courses and things like law or languages at the workplace, but that was offered not after hours, but during the workday, and because people were expected to go home and spend time with their families in the evening. And the, you know, the Finnish study, you know, really made note of this, because in Helsinki, in the cities, you know, this wasn't the case. It was much more like it is in the United States, and that gave them pause about overwork and working long hours, and was it productive? And the guy who headed up the study and I spent a couple days together, and he said, you know, many jobs you can do in 4 hours a day, and yet people work 10 or 12 hours a day. And it's just not a good thing. It makes people miserable. Here's an example of a place where people are expected to go home, and they're happy. So it was very interesting. And so I understand why people have problems with Finland.
Because there's a reason we're talking about them.
There's a reason we're talking about them. And the school I went to in Finland, by the way, was the poorest school in Helsinki, and it had a 50% immigrant population with serious problems. These kids came in with serious problems. So it's not, I think there's a myth that Finland is this Nordic paradise, and it's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. It's a mixed bag, just like everywhere else. But they work collectively, and they have that flexibility that, you know, Darwin talked about, right?
Yeah.
That has allowed them to survive and thrive in the 21st century. But they're still looking to improve. They're always looking to improve. They never sit back on their laurels. You're not going to find the president of Finland saying his is the greatest country on earth.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen, because they look at it quite critically, and they're very willing and eager to change when need be.
Yeah, that reminds me of the thing that Michael Lewis said about Danny Kahneman, that he looks at the world as if it were a problem, and that's not a negative. It's like everything's a problem to be solved, and so it's that puzzle, right, that's in front of you, and you can do that with a perfectly positive mindset. It doesn't mean, but that's the same thing with science. I mean, the science is wrong, right? It's always getting updated. So these absolutes that like, oh, it has to work this way, it's like, no, it doesn't. It never does. In fact, it always progresses. We just have this attitude that we settle into something, we don't want to see it change.
That's absolutely right. And if you look at children, your listeners who have small children in particular, you'll see how children have a natural both curiosity and willingness to fail. right?
Yeah.
And regroup and try things new, and that's how they learn and grow and develop. And I think as adults, we, you know, that's kind of pounded out of us. We have to have this certainty,
totally.
You know, especially on the job, we always have to show that we're in control, that we're leaders, and that we're, you know, and that's nonsense. You know, most of us aren't most of the time, and that's a good thing. You know, we strive to improve and learn and listen. And again, this is something that I certainly witnessed in Finland, and some lessons that we can learn from Finland. Humility, I'd say, is probably the most important one.
Yeah, humility, curiosity. Okay, so I'm gonna ask you for a yes and story, but before that, a couple of surprises that came out of your study around schools and education. And this one was so interesting to me. You say, quote, "The selectivity of the colleges from which applications are rejected is twice as predictive of their future incomes as is the selectivity of the college from which they graduated." All right, so what we're saying here is, if you look and see that this person got rejected from Stanford, Harvard, Yale, and ended up going to Bard, that says more than the fact that, like, someone just went to Harvard?
Yeah, this is just one statistic.
Yep.
And Bard is a particularly problematic school that you're bringing up. But I what happens generally, of course, if someone has been rejected from Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, maybe they're going to the University of Michigan, right?
Right.
Because they're a high achieving student, or they wouldn't be wasting their money applying to the most demanding schools in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
However, what this shows us, what this tells us, is the tenacity of these individuals, the self-confidence they have, right? They're confident. They may be a little arrogant. They're kids, right? They're 17 years old. But they have that confidence. And also, many of their guidance counselors have their confidence. And their parents, who are paying the fee to apply, have confidence. So really, showing that confidence and that tenacity, the willingness to go through the hoops to try to get into these places, is what characterizes their later success. And in fact, there have been studies on high schoolers who've gotten into places like Princeton and have declined them because of the cost,
mm-hmm.
and gone to their state schools and their flagship state schools like the University of Wisconsin, the University of Michigan, you know, whatever, you know, state school you might name. And they've done just as well as the kids who've gone to Princeton and Harvard. So it's, you know, this kind of pushing your kids into trying to get them into the ultimate academic situation may not be the best idea for them or for you, and it may be totally unnecessary. It may not get you what you're hoping your child will get.
It really depends
on the kid.
You just made me feel much better about my rejection and my son's rejection from Northwestern, so which is where my wife went.
Neither of us got in.
Neither of us got in. He went to Skidmore. I went to Lake Forest College. We're all doing great.
We're all doing great.
All right. So we end every one of these podcasts asking our guest for a yes and story, the idea being an improvisation that groups of people who are making something out of nothing, they can't do that effectively when they say no, and they actually can't do it effectively when they just say yes. They have to say yes and. They have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. That's how we do this thing. And I'm wondering, in your work or your life, if you've got a moment where you yes anded.
Well, I wish I had something more romantic or you know, thrilling to tell you. You know, honestly, writing this book, which was quite a long and involved project, I resisted doing it for a good long time. I really did. I knew how difficult it was, in part because it's a subject about which everyone has an opinion, right? And everyone kind of has their own facts as well.
Mm-hmm.
So those are always dangerous subjects to deal with. So I resisted doing this, for a while. I knew it was really fraught. But now that I've done it and I'm being out there and talking about it, I realize, you know, it was an incredibly worthwhile endeavor for me and hopefully for people who read it. Right. So
yeah.
I'd say, you know, I know this might seem self-serving, but I would say this is what pops to mind when you ask me, you know, what have I done that I resisted doing? You know, anything else, you know, I could tell you other stories, but they wouldn't be of this magnitude.
Yeah, no, that's a perfect yes and story. This book is a yes and. The book is called The Job: Work and Its Future in a Time of Radical Change. Ellen Rupol Shell, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Kelly. It's been a really fun time.